Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Beginners to stage.
How many times have I said not to touch the cross?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's Backstage at Cry Havoc. I am your host, Lowry Ann Davis, she, her, and today we're going to be talking about how to make murder funny. Because it is hilarious, apparently. And joining me to discuss this topic are David K. Barnes, Grace Knight, and Robert Valentine. Please, will you introduce yourselves with your pronouns and a little bit about you and your involvement in Cry Havoc? David, let's go first, since you are the seasoned backstager at this point.
Hello, I'm David, the seasoned backstager. He, him, the creator and lead writer on Cry Havoc.
Lovely. Alphabetical. Grace.
Hello, I'm Grace Knight, pronouns she, her, and I'm one of the writers on Cry Havoc, and I wrote the episode we're talking about today, episode 18.
And Rob.
Hi, I'm Rob Valentine, he, him, and yeah, I often come last in alphabetical lists, as I do today. And and I'm a writer, and I've written some of Cry Havoc. There you go.
Yeah. Well, we're also talking about episode 16 today, which is one of Rob's episodes. And on that note, episode 16 and 18, we've talked a bit about a 17. We've had Grace on before. What happens in 16 and 18? Do you want me to do a quick summary, or would you like to take your own episodes and tell everyone what they've just listened to, hopefully, really?
Oh, do you know what? You go ahead, because it'd be embarrassing if I forget.
Right. Episode 16. Oh, I should have written the titles down. That was silly.
Oh, it's called Daggers.
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is called Daggers. So, Mark and Cleo have just finally got together. Cleo has a request of Mark that, or a suggestion maybe, that he kills Gaius. And he doesn't want to. And then Cleo orders Charmian to. And then Mark talks to Fulvia, has a change of heart. Or at least is convinced by... I kind of think of him as having two Lady Macbeths, kind of pushing him to do this thing. And even then, it's not enough, because he gets to the room, looks at Gaius sleeping, and he can't bring himself to do it. Charmian comes in, and he inadvertently saves Gaius's life, which Fulvia is delighted about, naturally. Also, Gaius is writing a speech during this, which I'm really, really thankful we do not have to listen to, because it sounds like it would have been awful. So 17... we've discussed last time, and in episode 18, Rescue Charmian is mounted, if I am correct.
Yes.
And a very important list is written. Well, two important lists are featured in episode 18, and one may end up in the wrong place. I think that's enough of a summary, is it?
Yeah,
works for me.
I regret offering my services. So, a little rewind before we talk about the episodes themselves. Grace and David, I know you haven't worked together before. Rob and David, do you have a previous relationship to this? And Grace and Rob?
We've literally never met.
Yeah, this is our first meeting.
It is. I think we've been on the same email chains. That's literally as much as we can say. I liked your tone. Professionally at warm.
Thank you very much.
I know of Rob through Wireless Theatre and Big Finish. Indeed, I've written a script for Rob a few months ago, which was due about a year before. He was very, very kind. Very kind indeed. But this is the first time I think we properly actually worked together. It was on Cry Heaven. And it was lovely.
Yeah, this was our first experience of working together. And it was so much fun. I mean, one of the many draws of saying yes was just to get to work with David and kind of hope it was a nice thing. Fortunately, yeah. It was, because if it hadn't been, it would have sucked.
And this would have been a really awkward
time. This would have been a really, really tense conversation with, literal daggers being spat down, Skype at each other. But actually, it was huge, huge fun and just a really happy writing experience. For me, at least. And David had more to do than I did, but I could just kind of waft in, do my bit, then kind of saunter back out again. David was kind of in it for the long haul.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was huge fun to do.
Likewise, actually. I don't know if I said that on my last episode, but it was like you got exactly the right amount of support from David and from Amani, actually. And it was like I always felt very supported, but also massively free. So I think particularly because my episodes like had to change a lot because changes were made earlier in the series, and obviously mine were the latest ones that weren't literally written by David. It was like I just always felt so kind of respected as a professional, and but also so kind of supported that if there was anything I wanted to touch base with, I always could. It was just such a like pleasant writing experience, and it was just, I had a ball. It was great.
Oh, that's good.
So good job, David.
I'm going to type up those quotes and frame them. I'm very, very glad to hear it. Genuinely very glad. I think the role of a guest writer on a show should be to come in, have lots of lovely discussions, write lovely scripts, and then wander away, hopefully without a care in the world.
Yeah.
And it's the job of the head writer to then have all the multiple breakdowns afterwards going, oh my God, how's this all working? But it's there's always lots of work to do later on when you're trying to make sure reference to that has gone into this and that and the other thing. But I don't want to bother writers with that. It's just, you've given me a great script. I'm just going to turn those lines around. It'll be fine.
I would like to talk about the writer's room aspect of this, actually, because it's so interesting to me that, like, Rob's episode 16, it's the same scene, actually, as the opening of 18, right?
Opening 17,
and, like, the fact that... Oh, 17, sorry, maths. And the fact that you, Grace and Rob, hadn't, like, met before this to have an individual conversation is just mind-boggling to me. And, the fact that things would have changed... What kind of things were changing and how did that work?
Oh, David let me see an early draft of Rob's script just so I could see literally what was happening in the scene I was continuing to write, which I think was very useful just from the perspective of not losing my mind, but also in terms of kind of trying to get a tone match, because obviously it is a different episode, but if you're listening to them back to back, it's going to sound really weird if our interpretations of the characters are a bit off. And obviously David is going to edit and oversee that anyway, but it's better to just do the job properly the first time. And in terms of changes, I wrote my outlines for the episodes. Did I even write the first drafts? And then you were like, oh yeah, we've changed some things. Sorry.
Yes, I can't remember exactly what.
I can't remember at what stage. I remember laughing.
Yes.
Which...
Yes, I think there were a few points I did change. I think actually the point where Octavia found out that Charmian was working for Cleopatra changed. That did then have a knock-on effect, I think, on these characters know this knows this.
Yeah, so it's all stuff where I think things where the reveal scene had or hadn't been in my sections and I had to just kind of rejig. But yeah, I mean, it was always super clear what I needed to change. And actually, because David is very sweet and very keen for writers not to have to do any work, he was always okay, so I think the minimal change you can do is probably do this bit, just change this scene a bit. And I'm just it really is literally my job, so it is fine.
Yeah.
But
yeah. I don't like people who work. I just think it's impolite.
I've got to say that I, at one point in this backstage series, have wanted to say that I really appreciate that Octavia knows that Charmian is a spy from very early on.
Yeah.
So I think that was a great call because I think it makes their relationship more real. I hate it where you're supposed to be in love and really like each other and you've got this huge huge secret.
Yeah, and also I think it's much more narratively interesting for Octavia, because when she's totally floored by the assassination attempt, she's like, but you didn't tell me. And Charmian's like, yes, I really did.
Yes.
Like, and it really kind of illustrates Octavia's privilege as a character and her, like, inability to register that these things that she's doing are part of, like, real politics, that they actually matter and they're not just, like, her kind of having some japes.
I remember, actually, that's of the effect of Rob's episodes as well, because you've got the orgy episode and the episode 16 after. Yeah, me and Amani would often discuss when certain revelations should happen. I don't like too many to happen in one go. But I would say, yeah, they've just reached a point of Octavia and Charmy are a couple together as of the end of The Pirates, and that was always baked in at that point. But I thought, you know what, and I rang up Tom and said, you know, you're writing the episode, can you rewrite that last scene just one more time, but this time with the revelation of that she does say to Octavia, look, I'm a spy, da 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 da, and Octavia goes, and I thought, you know, actually it'd be quite fun if Octavia went, oh, you're a spy, that's really hot, yeah, sure, that's fine, and maybe just moved on from there. And I thought, it's a better way of expressing her sort of distaste for politics and thinking, oh, she's above it all. If she literally knows that her lover is a spy working for the opposition against her own brother and she doesn't feel the need to tell him or feel that that's even a conflict of interest until around at this point when it is. And then it just gives, I think it gives Octavia more, rather than just, oh my God, you lied to me. It's no, you, oh my God, I was also complicit in this and I am angry at myself, so I'm going to be even angrier at you as a result of that. And it gives Grace far more to do, gives Rob more to do in his scripts as well, and the Audie thing as well. It's like, well, you know what's going on here. Why are you getting annoyed at me? I like to give actors more to do as well. Just go, here's some stuff. Here's for the acting. The old
do a bit of acting. But I also think, Chloe, you make a really good point that it really is important for our buy-in into that relationship. Like, because I have the same problem you do. If there's kind of a rom-com setup where one of them is lying to the other one about, like, who they are or what they are or whatever, it's really hard to invest because you're just like, yeah, okay, but, you know, fundamentally, you have lied about, like, a lot of quite important stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I appreciate that, like, obviously that doesn't mean you're not taking the relationship seriously and all of that, but I just think it's just better if you can just invest, especially if the drama is going to come from these people being forced apart rather than, like, internal relationship drama.
And you are prevented from investing until both parties know each other properly, and until the revelation like that happens, you're just waiting for everyone to get up to speed with you, and then you can invest. What is fascinating about Octavia is that it's no different from, like, being born into any kind of powerful family, a mafia family or something.
Yeah.
She has all the information, but she doesn't understand the implications of any of it, and that's a failure of understanding and comprehension on her part, not a lack of knowledge.
Not a failure of knowledge. Yeah, absolutely. She's been so insulated.
Okay, so let's get to what this episode has been titled for, which is Murder and Assassination. I'm making it funny. You know, I've been thinking a lot about how to ask this, but I guess my question is, how do you do that? Because, like, it's horrible. And how do you go about making a topic that is so repulsive in a way? Is that too strong a word? No, murder's awful. And, like, the prescriptions, oh, sweet Lord, what I've learned over this series. How do you go about inserting comedy into a situation like that?
I think writers are quite distanced from the horror of murder because we kill off so many characters in scripts all the time.
Oh, interesting take.
I think all three of us have some experience writing that sci-fi or sci-fi adventure type stuff. And any given adventure story will have random people being bumped off by the monster of the week or some robot or whatever, and then somebody would, there'll be a heroic sacrifice or something. So murder and death happens quite a lot in writing, so I usually assume it's quite funny and then have to remind myself it's not. But I think it's context, isn't it? It's a context which a murder is done. If it's a cold-blooded killing done seriously with big serious intent, it's not funny, it's just sad. But if it's a murder done in panic, or if the person doesn't have the full context of what they're doing, or don't know that they're ruining somebody else's better murder plot by trying to carry out their own, that's quite funny, because then you're seeing people fail to do something, especially in a context where you'd expect they'd be very good at it because it's ancient Rome, therefore. And you realise, no, actually, even Mark Antony finds it hard to stab someone when they're not on a battlefield, and that's quite fun because it plays of our conception of who we think he is.
Rob and Grace, are you happy being tarred with that brush of writers who are just bored with murder now? It's commonplace.
I'm actually not, really not like that. I have written a lot of sci-fi because I love spaceships and time machines, but I'm very squeamish about killing people off, and I will, like, go to great lengths to avoid it. I think, for me, the whole purpose of episode 18, the whole way it's structured, because I reread it this morning just to remind myself what I said, the whole way it's structured is basically building to that decision. And so for a start, answer number one for how you make murder funny is put the murder in at the end, because then the rest of the episode's still funny. So I think really the question is, having done that in episode 18, how do you make episode 19 funny? So if you think about how episode 18 is structured, it's got this big subplot, which is like pure japes. It's literally a heist with silly hats and makeup and people a little bit out of their comfort zone. And it's like, let's go rescue your girlfriend. It's going to be really fun. And it's like just pure nonsense. But the A plot, it starts out completely light, like they're joking. They're like, oh, I wish we could do that. Oh, my God, who would you put on the list?
Yeah, it starts off funny and then sort of gets more serious as it goes, where I think Rob 16 is sort of the opposite, where it starts serious and people are very serious about death. And then once we actually get to it, it all goes wrong and it becomes very silly.
Yeah, well, that kind of comes on to kind of my perspective. I mean, as a writer, you do kill a lot of people. But in fiction, oftentimes you're dealing with symbols and, you know, certain storylines and characters representing certain things. And the death of a character is, in some ways, you know, you have a bit like a Jungian perspective on it. It can be the death of an idea, that kind of thing, which in some ways what stories do. But in terms of Cry Havoc and Daggers, it's not really about making the decision to kill people funny. It's just about highlighting that it's inherently ridiculous. Killing someone to solve your problem is the most permanent and stupid thing you can do. And people do it in real life. The whole idea of, you know, flying to the UK with, you know, some radioactive isotopes and, you know, or some nerve toxin to bump off a journalist or two is stupid. But this stuff happens. So really, Daggers is about the ridiculousness of murder as an extension of policy. I think that's really what it comes down to. And also, these decisions are so domestic. They're decisions, and the whole thing is about power. But these decisions made in bedrooms and kitchens, and that's kind of, you know, that's where these kind of decisions get made. They don't get made in the meeting rooms or delegation chambers or anything like that. They get made at the urinal, you know, and you know, it's and that's how this level of politics and power operates. And it's real, and it's horrible, and it's obscene. And yeah, you don't have to mine for the comedy really, because it's there just in the whole concept. And that's what Daggers is about.
I think there's a nice contrast that Daggers is all about very much of the personal. It's Mark Antony grappling the idea of personally putting the dagger in, personally carrying out his own murder, which is when he then sort of prevaricates quite a lot. When it gets to Grace's episode, they're all talking about people they'd like to kill. It's more distance. They're talking about it as if that's a thing that would be good to happen, and were it to happen, and at the end, they give it to some assassins to do, then they can just sit back and see what goes on. Mark finds it very difficult to do death when he has to personally do it himself, but it's much easier to talk about when it feels like a game. When somebody's saying, here's the dagger, go and kill that man, it's serious. When it's sitting around a table talking about it, you can disassociate yourself from the effects of what your actions will be, which is, I guess, a lot of the things in, you know, political decisions are made by people at a table or in a bar. And you can talk about it quite abstractly, but somebody somewhere is going to feel the very real effects of whatever policy you've made. That means they'll have less money in their pocket, or they can't afford that food, or they can't do this, or they're going to get bumped off by an assassination conspiracy that's gone wrong. And there's something different about that. They Gaius and Mark and Epidus do lots of laughing in Grace's episode 18, because it's all up there. Mark doesn't do any laughing at all in 16, because it's people are standing right around and going, go on then, you personally go and do it. And that's quite funny, because the big general can't bring himself to go and, you know, enact what should be a perfectly simple assassination plot, and he totally fails. And then there's the seriousness of, I suppose, the contrast of asking somebody with great power to do something like that against asking someone like Charmian, who has no power at all in this, to go and do something that she clearly doesn't want to do. Mark could probably talk himself out of it if he wanted to. Charmian can't do that. She's got to go and try and kill Gaius because Cleopatra's told her to, and there is no choice to it. And that's a real sort of tragedy. So you can have your serious plot line of Charmian and your comedy plot line of Mark, which then hit each other at the end and turn into a punchline.
But also in Mark Antony's case, he is a soldier. He's killed lots of people, but he's not an assassin. He's going into it thinking, yeah, I've killed before. Yeah, I've done it loads. It's a really simple thing to do. But then he's faced with murdering a colleague in their sleep, and it shows you what he is and what he isn't.
Yeah, but I think you make a very good point that, like, having episode 18 happen in the context of Mark's failure of humanity, essentially, like, he couldn't do it. I think it really is very interesting that by the end of the episode, he's sentenced 12 people to death, as far as he knows, you know.
Yes.
And done it without a second thought, and done it by, you know, just incrementally getting used to the idea and deciding that they, you know, they were worth it. And the thing is as well, I think it's worth remembering that both of these people have done this before, like asked for people to be assassinated before. Like, I mean, got Crassus and what's-his-name murdered, you know, before the start of the series. Like, they're not very nice people and they don't have very clean hands.
That's the other thing, I suppose, that comes into, yeah, like, what, you must assume that if you're going to murder a bunch of people, someone's going to want to murder you, so... Why not consider that?
Yeah, that's the logical conclusion.
That might actually be one difference between Mark contemplating assassinating Gaius and the assassinations later. The assassinations later are to help maintain the status quo rather than create a brand new unknown situation that Mark hasn't got any real idea what it'll be like, him, you know, figuratively, not literally, in bed with Cleopatra and in charge.
Yeah.
And with the target on his back. And I think just in terms of, you know, the way we all behave conservatively. And I think we tend to do a lot more to maintain what we know than go into a new realm of unknowns.
Yeah, in episode 18 and beyond, they want to kill off a bunch of people to get the money to pay off soldiers so we can just, like, return to square one. Whereas I suppose, yes, killing off Gaius creates a different... What does the future hold? How will Mark rule? What's going to actually happen? And that's quite frightening. If you're just trying to get things back to how they were, or to square something off, that's sometimes easier, unless you get it wrong and accidentally sign the death sentence for about 100 and 200 people because they're on Lepidus's birthday list. That was a ridiculous idea, which I mentioned it to a consultant like at the very beginning, and they went, that sounds very funny. I went, okay, the consultant liked it, I'll keep it, because I thought that's ridiculous, but all right, it's the best way I could think of having something like innocent get in the way and cause great devastation, which is, I think, where it's to take 19, which I think has just been released, which is the fallout of them realising what they've done and essentially panicking about it. And actually, I remember now, because this is one of the bits of plotting that I came up with very, very early on, is how we're going to end the series. And for some reason, I just watched Dr. Strangelove, which is a 1960s film about an American general who sort of loses the plot, essentially, and sends planes with nuclear bombs into Russia to attack Russia and then instigate a nuclear war. It's a very dark, satirical farce, but there is a point where all the American president and all the characters around him, all the advisors, are looking at this big map, and they can see all the planes going out to their targets, and they're wondering, do we recall them? If this does happen, do we commit to it because they will attack us, or do we try to help the Russians to not do this? What do we do? Do we own this? How do we play this situation for maximum political effect and to keep our jobs? And that's the bit where I thought, oh, what if... The main characters in this have signed the wrong warrants and assassins are going out across the Republic and they don't know whether they should get them back, own up to it, not own up to it, blame someone else, and they just panic. And the longer they spend discussing it, the fewer options they will have. So I nicked that because writers like nicking things. And that's where that came from.
It's a lesser crime than murder, so, you know.
Is it? Is it?
Ah, okay. No, let's not go there. Let's not go there. A question has just occurred to me that I haven't given you a heads up about, but I have faith. Why make murder funny? Ooh.
Well, I'd say there's no need, because in a way it is already. It all depends on the perspective you choose to present it in, because it's inherently ridiculous and one of the most imbecilic things a human being can possibly do to another human being for multiple reasons. So, yeah, if you squint right, it is funny.
I've thought on that, but Grace, continue yours.
Okay, well, so one thing, I've thought of another answer to the how to make murder funny question, which is like basic writing 101, focus on the perpetrator, because it's really only funny for them. And why make it funny? I think because it's quite difficult for humans to engage with the things that they don't like about humans in any kind of meaningful way. I think we don't enjoy, because we're basically empathic creatures, thinking about humans being brutal or cruel or barbaric. We don't like thinking about just all of this like horrible stuff. But I think humans are basically creatures of context. And I think that is the only explanation that it allows me to make sense of the vast, vast array of different behaviours that we're capable of.
Mm.
And I think the only way we're going to understand that is if we are willing to engage with the possibility that we were angels and the possibility that we were demons. And I think for that, you have to be able to engage with it. And so I think by making it funny, it's a way of engaging with it in a way that is emotionally a little bit less hard on the listener. And also, I think, as Rob says, by exposing the ridiculousness of it, it kind of undermines its power a little bit. Which is also an interesting way, because there have been lots of studies that have demonstrated that the idea of violence in video games leading to real-life violence is sheer nonsense. However, I do think that we do have a bit of a tendency, particularly if we are a major HBO drama, to sort of glamorise the ability to be a, like, ruthless killer and that kind of thing. And I think the best weapon against that kind of like, yeah, but it's a bit cool, isn't it, kind of attitude is a send-up.
Yeah.
And so I think there's something quite powerful about taking someone with enormous power and just making them look silly.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think it was Francois Truffaut said that he thought it was impossible to make an anti-war film because cinema can't tackle the subject of war without making it look cool.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of murder, it's... Killing people is a horrific thing, but there's a pathetic weakness in people deciding to kill other people. And I think one of the places that comedy comes from in that is a degree of relief about that revelation, but also the gap between the expectation and the result of someone in a comic piece deciding to kill someone and then the outcome. And because it's such a dark subject, that relief is great.
Partly it's the motivation of, like, I think murder in itself isn't funny. And a story, for instance, in which a very capable assassin finds their victim and bumps them off is not funny. That's just somebody, you know, that could be very suspenseful, could be quite dangerous. But I think Grace is quite right. So it's not funny. If you concentrate on the victim, it's not funny, because all you'll see is either somebody who doesn't know what's happening to them or abject distress. So you concentrate on the person who's going to do the killing. If it's somebody who can do it perfectly well, that's still not going to be very entertaining. So it's the context in which the character is. If it's a person who has no idea what they're doing, and what you're enjoying there is the sort of the relief of taking something which is very serious and finding the silliness in it, which is, oh dear, I don't know what I'm really scared. What if I ruin this? What if I get it wrong? What if something? That can be quite fun because it's something that we can relate to. Or whereas, if it's a powerful person doing it and then getting it wrong, we can sort of use that as a way to laugh at power. I think murder, like death generally, having just, you know, I came off a sitcom about funerals for 4 seasons where we tried to get the last out of death there. It's just because it is one of those very big subjects about which we always have a slight agitation. So the smallest smile or laugh can sort of give us a great deal of relief. Because I suppose that's one thing about comedy and great deal of, you know, sort of murder and murder plots, both rely on suspense of a sort. Which is why I think as audiences we find, you know, so Alfred Hitchcock's movies were very entertaining because they were very suspenseful, and we kind of like that. We enjoy knowing what's going to happen and hiding behind a pillow or laughing out loud. Comedy and suspense and horror are all along the same kind of line. It just depends on whose side you're on, whether it's slow or fast, but they always say that comedy is tragedy sped up. And I think just the manner in which it's presented. I don't find distress very funny at all. I'm sure most people would agree, you know, the signs of distress aren't very funny. But if an assassin walks into, like, a room and it's somebody in bed and they go, oh my God, and they start crying, please don't kill me, that's not funny. If somebody walks into your room with a sword and you go, oh, for God's sake, what now? That is funny, because it's just a subversion of expectations and a different attitude. And then eventually, if that scene ends with the person in the room arguing the assassin out of them, saying, I've had it up to here, I've had a terrible day, I've done this, this and this, and you're here, no, we're going to do it tomorrow, if you're going to kill me, do it tomorrow, I'm tired, I'm having to, and kick him out, I find quite funny. And then you'd be with the assassin going, how did I get argued out of that room? All I had to do was stab him, but I'm gonna have to go and book a room now. Okay, fine, I'm gonna go downstairs and, all right.
That is correct, hilarious. But also, part of the reason that's funny is because you're no longer dealing with a powerless victim.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Like, so you get the laugh out of the surprise of, like, I'm sorry, seriously, not another thing. But then you also get the kind of relief of, like, oh, okay, it's actually going to be fine, isn't it? Like, this person's going to talk their way out of this.
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just the examination of power as to, is murder funny? No, not inherently. But it, as a prism to examine power, like Rob was saying, you know, the sheer need to murder someone at all indicates a very weird sort of psychological power that you've had to resort to that. So that could be ridiculous. But it depends on who the victim is and who the perpetrator is. A person with very little power setting out to murder somebody at the, like, you know, at the top of society is a different story from somebody with a lot of power picking up somebody who has no power at all.
Yeah.
And it's how murder reflects that imbalance, and then yes, the subversion of expectation. And say somebody like in all those horror films that have like a serial killer hunting after somebody at the end, and they're using their ingenuity to try and get away, are suspenseful. They're not funny, but there are plenty of films with assassinations and murders, or even horror comedies, which get lots of laughs out of a serious situation in which the characters are just responding in a way we're not used to seeing. Usually, irritation.
Yeah. Irritation is hilarious.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Something else I think is important, and I haven't decided in which direction, is that the victims they're talking about killing are a bunch of senators we know to be corrupt.
Yeah.
Or at least we know to be presented by the narrative and by Gaius and Mark as having failed morally.
Yeah. And they're characters we've not really met that much. We've seen a couple of senators, but we don't spend much time with them, so they're quite faceless.
So actually the only thing we know about them is that they're rich,
yeah.
Which I think is obviously a pretty good cipher for power, so that makes them a bit less sympathetic.
Yeah, I think if it were, let's sit around, let's see if we can, like, kill off all the people in the poor quarters and the slums, that I don't think there'd be any way in which we'd be going power, but then we wouldn't be going that way anyway, because it's a bunch of, you know, some people whose job it is to tell all these people, just blow them in the Senate, you know, to try and work with them on a solution, and nobody can. I think, well, let's just kill them.
Yeah.
And because they're all very rich people, as you say, who are corrupt, and who we've only seen, the only times we see them in the series is usually to obstruct plans which might have otherwise worked, were it not for self-interest.
What can be funny, though, is if you're having some kind of policy, economic policy meeting, and then the decision to murder the poor is suddenly funny.
Oh, hilarious. Every time.
That's a Mitchell and Webb sketch, isn't it? The sort of like, kill the poor? Are you... What?
I think one way to mind the comedy, there's the killing side, which is the delicate side, but the place to mind the arch ridiculousness of it is the decision to kill and the act are the two... They're the two far ends of making murder funny.
Yes, because the joke then is on the person who's coming up with the idea. It's like the joke isn't that it would be funny to go and destroy these people. The joke is that there are people in society who you can bet are at the top
exactly,
of the chain
yeah.
going, oh, it's sacred, I could... So it's a joke about the horrendous moral vacuity of people in that society, but it's not a joke about the murder itself.
Absolutely. I also think there is a kind of knee-jerk response. Like every time my partner comes in and tells me something the Tories have been up to recently, I laugh.
Yes.
It's not exactly that I think it's funny.
No.
But it's sort of almost like incredulity. Like,
yes.
Because obviously if he's bothered to mention it to me, it's because it's like wild by the standards of what I already expect from Tories, which is like pretty out there. So it's like, yeah. Okay.
Almost if you don't laugh, you'll cry kind of
yeah,
right there.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Yes.
Although, yeah. God, I hope that's not the note we've hit with this show.
Right, I'm going to wrap us there. Because it's not. Thank you so much, all three of you, for joining me for this. It was very, very interesting. And we have run long again, and that is all my fault. I'm sorry, but I'm not really, because I enjoyed it. So thank you, audience, for listening. I hope you enjoyed. And I hope you listen to the final episode. It should be coming out next week. So I hope you're all excited for that. And I will say goodbye, because we will be back with Backstage next week. And would everyone like to say goodbye with me? Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Backstage at Cry Havoc is a podcast distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 4.0 international license. It is directed by Amani Zardot, produced by Laurie Ann Davis, with executive producers Alexander J. Newell and April Sumner. This episode was edited by Laurie Ann Davis and Catherine Vernella. Thanks for listening.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.